board there. Frantz Fanon's book, he is a black Algerian psychiatrist, and this book has been very much a bestseller, both among black youth and white radicals. Basically, he describes the whole psychological problem of black people in colonial society. And this book has been important for the movement, both by sort of suggesting that resistance and rejection, even violence, is really necessary to establish the humanity of dehumanized people, that they have to throw off the whole kind of psychological domination of the oppressing society. And secondly, of course, it has been a way of sort of linking up the black struggle in America with the colonial struggle abroad. And so both of those things have been reasons why this book has become an important symbol. Greer and Cobb's book, Black Rage, is a little bit extreme title for the content of the book. These, again, are two black psychologists, and they have studied the way in which the black inferiority complex, black paranoia, what they call cultural paranoia, the expectation that you're going to be cut down and so forth, tends to rob black people of their manhood and make them dysfunctional. They get into a kind of a failure syndrome and so on because they don't have a strong ego due to the kind of psychological effects of the oppressing society. It has a number of case studies. I think it's a very useful book, very simple to read and so on. Julius Lester's book, which has the horrendous title of Look Out, Whitey, Black Pals Gonna Get Your Mama. he obviously was, you know, wanted to write a book so he could give it that title. Again, the contents are somewhat less exciting than the title. Basically, it's a kind of a study of the civil rights movement from the old integrated period up into black power. Then Malcolm X, the basic book here would be his autobiography, a book which I think, you know, everyone ought to read. It's the story of his whole growth as a person from his original ghetto background to his final discovery of a humanity beyond racism and so on. And then Eldridge Cleaver, his prison book is Soul on Ice, again a very good book. And then since he's been a fugitive, the Ramparts people have published, he worked as an editor for Ramparts, the Ramparts people gathered together his speeches and the things he wrote for Ramparts, and it's kind of a heterogeneous collection, even includes a Playboy interview that he did, and which happens, I think, to be one of the best things in it, and gathered these together and published them. And it kind of gives you the Cleaver, you know, beyond his prison experience. Now, Monday, for those of you who were in my talk, I tried to trace the older black separatist tradition from the Civil War and the slave uprisings and what I call black Zionism, the effort to go back to find a black homeland somewhere else, the black nationalism and so on, up to the black Muslim movement, which combines black separatism and nationalism with some kind of apocalyptic doctrine of a new age to come which will overthrow the white devil and so on. And which also combines this with a kind of a program of Negro self-help. Now today what I want to do is trace the civil rights movement from the late 1950s, very briefly trace this up to the point where it meshes with this black separatist tradition and breaks with its original alliance with white liberals. And then try to see how this separatist, as the civil rights movement breaks with the white alliance and meshes with black separatism, it has then sort of moved on to a position that's really beyond the black Muslim position. Okay. The original civil rights movement, of course, was not sponsored by the black separatist wing of the black community, but rather by what we called last time the black middle class, which has always pursued a policy of integration, which has tried to to incorporate themselves into the American covenant. These were the leaders of the original civil rights movement. They were the ministers of the black community, the black civic leaders. Martin Luther King, of course, Bayard Rustin, these kind of black civic and religious leaders, which have always, which have been the leaders of the black middle class, and which have pursued a integrationist policy over against this more ghetto tradition of black separatism. So this group, you know, sort of had struggled, you know, all along. In the 50s, these were the people who through NAACP got through fought the segregation of school question up to the Supreme Court. President Neybrot, who is the outgoing president of Howard University, was one of the lawyers who argued that case and so forth. So these were the people who led the original civil rights movement, and it began with the bus boycotts in Montgomery. This was kind of the signal for a new kind of struggle. It moved into the black college, the southern black college student who led the lunch counter sit-ins. The whole tactics of this movement was to present a very acceptable image of the black person as a person who simply wanted justice in the society. The demonstrator was always very neat, you know, you wore a suit and a tie and a white shirt, and you were trained not to respond violently, because in effect you wanted to exhibit an image of the unjust society while presenting yourself as wanting nothing but justice and so forth. So it was kind of therapeutic, if you will, toward the white majority who you were trying to get to see the injustice of this kind of thing and so on. So that was the tactics of the old civil rights type of demonstration. It went through the lunch counter sit-ins, the freedom rides, which tried to break the segregation of interstate transportation and so on. And out of this impetus, you might say, the movement was born. It was started by black civil rights leaders and religious leaders and black college students, but in the early 60s, it was very much joined by a whole group of sort of disaffiliated young white college students who found in this something that they could really do and so on. With this alliance, then the movement went into new organizations. SNCC was created as a kind of youth arm of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is Martin Luther King's organization. SNCC was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Community, as some people later said. As it developed, it became neither students nor nonviolent nor coordinating nor committee. But nevertheless, the high point of this integrated civil rights movement was probably the Mississippi summer of 1964, in which, of course, the two white and one Negro youth were murdered and buried in a dam in Mississippi. This was an attempt, sort of an all-out attempt at voter registration, in other words, to break the disenfranchisement of the Negro in the South. It sort of concentrated on voter registration drives. Out of the discouragement of that summer, there came a new political party, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which tried to win recognition as the genuine Democratic Party at the Democratic Convention. They were put down at that time, but they did win. They went back and formed a new coalition and did win recognition as the genuine Democratic Party in the following convention. So, you know, here was an example of a new organization that did, in fact, prove its ability to create a new coalition in the South. And there's no doubt that the fruits of that struggle are being seen now with it was a frustrating fight at the time, but there's no doubt that the black man is becoming enfranchised in the South, and more and more he is winning political office. Charles Evers winning the mayorship of the little town of Fayette, Mississippi, of course, is a kind of a small landmark in that. The last Democratic convention really saw the effects of this in the Southern delegations, and so on. So this was that struggle to overcome Negro disenfranchisement, and at the time it seemed pretty frustrating. I mean, many of the young blacks felt that, you know, this really showed that the white man was never going to let them in. And I think since that time, that kind of frustration has proved a little premature, because we can see that things are moving, although slowly. Okay. At the end of 1964, as I said, the black youth and so on were pretty frustrated by what appeared to be just a solid block of resistance against them, and it seemed like they had to break into some kind of new kind of tactics. In other words, it seemed as though to create social revolution simply by legislation would never work, because you just got new laws on the books which the local power structure would simply never implement. So you had to, now they said, well, we have to change the local power structure, because they're just never going to implement these laws as long as it's the same old rednecks who are in power, and so on. So a new sort of phase developed of community organization. You had to organize the black community for power. Economic boycotts, new independent political parties such as the Freedom Democratic, Mississippi Democratic Party, new economic organizations like black unions, black cooperatives. These became sort of the new tactics of 1965. That was the summer that I was in Mississippi. And the general feeling then was you can't integrate the old organizations because they're inherently racist. You have to create new structures, new economic, political, social structures, and so on. And so for black people and out of this sort of create new society and new presuppositions. So that was the kind of thing that was going on then. And some of those organizations are still with us. The Poor People's Co-op, for example, is still providing sort of crafts for unemployed black people in the South, which are sold across the nation and so on. But then gradually, out of this struggle, it became apparent that this whole question was not simply a Southern question, as many white liberals like to think, those dirty old rednecks in the South. I mean, we're not this way in the North, of course. This kind of assumption that it was just a regional problem began to break down. It became apparent that this was a national problem, that the black man had perhaps even more difficulties perhaps even harder to break in the Northern ghetto, and that finally that this was not a black problem but a white problem. And this was in the summer of 65, Ebony magazine put out this issue called The White Problem in America, that tried to show that this whole thing really rested upon a racist social structure in America as a whole. So the struggle sort of widened out from a regional problem to a national problem, from an assault on black problems to a critique of American social structure as a whole. It began to be seen that this thing was operating not merely against blacks, but against Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, Indians, poor whites, and so on. You know, that you had a whole layer of sort of disenfranchised, underemployed people at the bottom of this affluent society. The campus movement erupted as a kind of challenge to higher education, which was now seen to be a part of this this kind of power elite. And you began to sort of talk about, the power structure, is somehow an interlocking sort of enemy. Military, industrial, educational, whole kind of power structure, which not merely produced a racist policy at home, but also produced imperialism abroad. In other words, now people began to sort of take a global perspective, very simplistic, I think, but nevertheless, to make this kind of thing make any sense, you'd have to do a lot more subtle analysis. But nevertheless, there was this kind of widening and shifting of perspective till now people began to see this as really a global problem, that America was a big sort of fat imperialist around the world, and there was a tendency to link racism at home with imperialism abroad, to bring in the war issue as intimately connected with the race issue, and so on. So here was this kind of widening of perspective, which went into the kind of assumption, what we would call present-day radicalism in America. Okay, now, by the fall of 65, the honeymoon alliance of white and black young radicals began to break up. It became apparent that these two groups that had gotten together so intensively in the Southern experience really had an awful lot not in common, you might say so, and that the white youth tended to be quite insensitive to the psychic dimension of black liberation. In other words, they tended to assume that black and white youth could get together, on a common economic political struggle. They tended to be quite unaware of the psychic dimension of black liberation, the extent to which the very presence of white people tended to intimidate black people and to make them feel that they were still being dominated, even by the white radical and so on, that the very presence of white people were a symbol of oppression to black people, and so on like that. The white youth tended to be quite insensitive on the sexual issue, which was a tremendously traumatic thing for black youth that had come out of the Southern experience, where the black woman is available to the black man, whereas if the black man, even looks at a black woman, he can be, traditionally has just been strung up and murdered and so forth. And this whole dimension of, interpersonal relations between black and white males and females, the white youth, didn't understand this at all and didn't realize at all what kind of traumatic thing this was and so on. So the black youth, the white youth were sort of being led into a whole kind of experience, the background of which they at first didn't understand at all, and all kinds of very traumatic things happened. They suddenly began to realize what they as white people meant to black people, a whole kind of history of black of terrorism and castrations and lynchings and burnings, which the white northern youth just didn't have as a part of his historical memory, but which the black youth lived with as an intimate part of their historical memory and so on. Now all of this, of course, was a part of, getting to know each other, but it was a pretty kind of traumatic way of getting to know each other. We were finding out each other's experiences and so on. Finally, the black youth movement simply came out and said, get out, Whitey. We just cannot pursue our goals with you around. You bug us. Go away. So we can get ourselves together. It's really kind of what they said. And this, of course, was terribly shocking to the white youth. I don't think the white radicals have gotten it over it yet, that they're still kind of bleeding inside from having, been so willing to give their lives to the black youth and then being told to, say, would you please just exit, this is still a deep hurt, and I think the white radicals are still kind of groping around for some way to make a new alliance with the black movement, and I think have not by any means found a way to do that. The black youth movement is very suspicious of the white radical. They tend to be quite contemptuous of hippies, by the way. They tend to see hippies as a typical example of the sickness of white society. Here are the children of the white middle class, and we see what sick people they are, that they produce these kind of children and so on like this. Very, very interesting. There's a kind of contemptuousness, and of course it comes from the fact that these people they're coming out of very different backgrounds and they're reacting to different things and so on. Because, of course, the black youth is all into this kind of manhood bag, he wants to show how manly he is. And he, people who have coming out of white society where you know, you've had a lot of guns at home and you're trying, you know, you're sort of reacting against that with flower power, you know, that's two different kinds of struggles. So they, you know, there's a great deal of misunderstanding which has by no means been overcome. Example of this is the SDS, and the white radicals who've practically been willing to just lie right down on the floor and be stepped on. If the black people would just, you know, let them follow them, you know. This took the form in this last year of the SDS just kind of giving a blanket endorsement to the Black Panthers, and then Julius Lester proceeded to write an article back to this saying, this is just another example of white paternalism. And so I like that. And then, of course, Kathy Cleaver, who's Eldridge's wife, who's a very beautiful girl, and it happens to come from a very elite kind of background, actually. She tries very hard to look blacker than she is. She always isn't very black, but she frizzes up her hair real high, so she'll really look Afro and so. But anyway, she was really mad at Julius Lester, and she wrote back and told him off. You know. But anyway, I'll read you a statement from 1965, the Vine City Project paper on whites in the movement, which came out just prior to Stokely Carmichael's sort of unveiling of black power, and you can see what they said at that time, and I think they're quite aware of the psychological dimension. I mean, they're really quite aware of the fact that they're just not ready to get themselves together with white people yet. This is an excerpt from it. The inability of whites to relate to the cultural aspects, this is why white people have to move out, because of the inability of white people to relate to the cultural aspects of black society. Attitudes that whites, consciously or unconsciously, bring to black communities about themselves, Western superiority, and about black people, paternalism, inability to shatter white-sponsored community myths of black inferiority and self-negation, inability to combat views in the black community that white organizers, being white, control black organizers as puppets, insensitivity of both black and white workers toward the hostility of the black community on the issue of interracial relationships, sex, the unwillingness of whites to deal with the roots of racism that lie within the white community. Whites, though individually liberals, are symbols of oppression to the black community due to the collective power that whites have over black lives. In other words, even though you may be personally a liberal, you know, just your white face bugs us because of the collective power which you people have over our lives. Blacks, in fact, feel intimidated by the presence of whites because of their knowledge of the power that whites have over their lives. One white person can come into a meeting of black people and change the complexion of that meeting. The white people should go into the white communities where the whites have created power for the express purpose of denying blacks human dignity and self-determination. In other words, your role is to go back and work on your own folk and get out of our yard. Whites who come into the black community with ideas of change seem to want to absolve the power structure of its responsibility for what it is doing, and to say that change can only come through black unity, which is the worst kind of paternalism. It's, you know, kind of a strange statement. This is not to say that whites have not had an important role in the movement. In the case of Mississippi, their role was the very key in that they helped blacks to get the right to organize. In other words, we're not saying you haven't helped, you know. We say you have helped. You really, in fact, you were really just very important at this point. But that role is now over, and it should be. There can be no talk of hooking up, in other words, between black and white movements, unless black people organize blacks and white people organize whites. If these conditions are met, perhaps at some later date, and if we are going in the same direction, talks about exchange of personnel, coalition, and other meaningful alliances can be discussed. Okay, so this was the kind of break that black people simply had to get themselves together. They had to organize their own community. They had to really find their own identity. They had to find out what they could do for themselves. And white people had to clear out. And if white people want to know what they ought to do, well, why don't you go back and work on your white community, where, after all, the real problem really lies, you know. why don't you, go back and convert that white daddy of yours instead of coming down here and, you know, painting our house and so on. Oh, whitewashing our house. Now, with this break, as I said, this was a traumatic kind of break for the white radical. He sort of continually tried to find a new basis of coalition. He's been fairly consistently rebuffed by the black movement up to the time of the Panthers, which we will discuss in a little while. Now, with this break, the white radicals, as I'll talk about Friday, kind of split into two groups, the sort of revolutionary militants, the SDS kind of faction, and the hippie dropout faction, and they sort of went a separate way, although still constantly looking to the black movement as some kind of standard, and hoping for some kind of new alliance. I mean, they have never given up the idea that the black community is the sort of prophetic community for America. The black movement then kind of went into its own thing. The black youth very much then attempted to move into the relationship with the black community generally. And in doing this, it sort of absorbed into itself the older tradition of black separatism, or was the black movement breaking with integrated SNCC, then sort of reappropriated this older tradition of black separatism and black nationalism, and took it up into the new stages of black liberation. And this, of course, creates a lot of sort of contradictory things. Because on the one hand, you might be demanding a lot of civil rights movements, a lot of civil rights type of stuff, you know, where you're still talking about guaranteed annual income and these kind of things, which you expect to get from the government. But on the other hand, you might be sort of simultaneously talking about, you know, founding a black homeland or something like that. And these things don't seem to go very well together. I remember the big sort of black caucus meeting met, a number of black organizations got together, and they issued a whole bunch of demands, the sort of cap off was that they demanded a guaranteed annual income, and at the same time said that they were going to leave America and found a separate black nation, which would seem to be, you know, you can do one or the other, but it's pretty hard to do both. So I think that there's a lot of contradictory stuff in black radicalism that comes from sort of fusing together an old black separatist tradition with a civil rights tradition, which really had different goals. The one was to separate out, and the other one was to integrate. And this has by no means been resolved in black minds of what they really want, you know, what their goals really are. Now let me go back and to the black Muslims and kind of indicate how that older black separatist tradition was sort of taken up into black power. The sort of transitional figure here is doubtless Malcolm X. Malcolm X, of course, as you probably know, was a black Muslim minister. He was a man who came out of an extremely depressed ghetto background. His father had been gunned down when he was a boy. As a youth, he sort of fell into all the traps of ghetto life as a pusher and so on like that. Found himself in prison. In prison, the message of the black Muslims came to him, as indeed is the chief place, or one of the chief places, where the black Muslims do their proselytizing. They're very successful with black prisoners. The message of Elijah Muhammad came to Malcolm X as a real liberation. For the first time, he seemed to understand what his problems were all about when, you know, the discovery, you know, that the black man has been dehumanized and white society is a devilish society, so on like that. out of this kind of new sense of identity, he simply kind of transformed his life in prison. He was virtually illiterate. He taught himself to read and went into this tremendous program of self-education, just reading everything that was in the prison library. This is not untypical of people who get themselves together in prison. Eldridge Cleaver did the same thing, where you discover that a prison can be like a monastery, where you can have enormous amounts of solitude and you can organize your life in an extremely disciplined way. In Eldridge Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, he tells about his fascination, but at the same time resistance to Thomas Merton. He read Thomas Merton in prison, and he was fascinated and yet repelled by the similarities between the kind of self-discipline he was developing in prison and this guy Merton, who was sort of voluntarily choosing to be in a kind of prison, namely a monastery, in order so that he could have a similar kind of solitude and disciplined life. And Eldridge Cleaver is both fascinated by this and at the same time kind of horrified that anybody would choose to be in prison, in effect, and so on. So anyway, Malcolm X also found the possibilities of the solitude and the strict kind of discipline of prison life to develop his own, kind of a very solitary contemplative sort of life. He describes, he'd get up at 5:30, regular program of exercises for half an hour. Then he'd pray for, half an hour or something like that. And he had regular sort of contemplation. Then he'd spend the day reading, studying, writing, and so on. After he got out of prison, he became one of the most valued ministers of Elijah Muhammad. He became the chief organizer of the Muslim temple in New York. He was built a strong organization there, and it was really due to Malcolm X's effectiveness that the black Muslims began to come to the attention of white America. In other words, white America had tended to be quite ignorant of black ghetto movements. It was the black Muslims had been around for 15, 20 years, but they were unaware of them, and it was only when a figure of the stature of Malcolm X emerged as a leader that white America suddenly became aware of groups of this kind. Then came what Malcolm X describes in his book as the great break with Elijah Muhammad. He discovered that the prophet was somewhat less prophetical than he had thought. He discovered various kinds of financial and sexual indiscretions of the prophet and so on like this. And this, this kind of broke the original belief, in effect, of the infallibility of the prophet. The true that he no longer could believe that Elijah Muhammad was really the true prophet when he discovered these things. He continued to revere him, but he sort of lost the innocence of his original conversion. And Elijah Muhammad, in turn, became increasingly suspicious of him. He was just a little bit too strong, a little bit too powerful. He was afraid that he couldn't control Malcolm X and so on. So finally came the break between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. And Malcolm X then went on to found his own independent organization. Now, the key change that he also went through is that he also, at this point, went on pilgrimage to Mecca because he really wanted to be a true Muslim. He didn't want, and he wasn't really sure whether he'd gotten, the word from Elijah. So he wanted to, go over there to the homeland and find out whether he had really gotten this religion straight, because he really thought that he was a Muslim. He really wanted to be a true believer in this religion. So he went to Mecca, and there he made a kind of remarkable discovery, namely that Islam itself is not racist, but that in the context of this religious brotherhood, people of all races are brothers. And for the first time, he discovered white people as brothers, as fellow Muslims, and this was a kind of a tremendous discovery. In a certain sense, he had to break out of America and go someplace else, break out of the whole domination of this society to discover that the white man could really be a brother in religion and in that context a real brother and so on. And so he began to reject the sort of racism of the black Muslims, the idea that the black man as such is a white devil. He instead began to see that it's the white system, the collective organization, the presuppositions, which are the devilish things rather than the white man. It's and that the white man is also a victim of this system, and so on. So it's the system that has to be changed, rather than the white man as such who is evil. He also discovered a new possibility of an international dimension to black liberation, that black liberation in America is really part of a whole struggle of colonial, non-Caucasian people around the world, and so on. So he went beyond racism, but at the same time sort of went beyond America to a sort of international view of this whole problem. Now, with this sort of new revelation, he came back to New York to try to found a new organization, a new program. His program consisted of an effort to raise the black struggle in America to international dimensions, and perhaps even including an appeal to the UN against what now came to be seen as a colonialism of black people in America. He wanted to try to raise the black man's perspective himself to a international dimension, to so that they would see themselves as part of a larger struggle. But he also wanted to overcome a dogmatic racism and to build his movement on a solidarity of all mankind, of all religions and races, around the themes of justice and brotherhood. In other words, he felt that that the new program had to be built really upon a sense of the common humanity of all men. He felt that this still had to be achieved by a separatism between black and white America, not on a dogmatic basis, but on a functional basis. That black Americans still had to get together their own movement, because they were a depressed people, and only if they got together their own movement, ran it themselves, financed it themselves, etc., could they really find out, you know, how to be fully human. In other words, he took from the black Muslims the idea of Negro self-help, that the Negro has to help himself, and liberation cannot come from others. Liberation cannot be a gift to you from others. It's something that you have to find for yourself, and it's not something that can be handed to you. A person has to regenerate himself and his own soul. He has to find his own dignity. He has to find what he can do for himself if he's going to stand up as a man. Here's a little section from his autobiography, which I think exhibits what he says here. I said that on the American racial level, we had to approach the black man's struggle against white racism as a human problem, that we had to forget hypocritical politics and propaganda. I said that both races, as human beings, had the obligation, the responsibility of helping to correct America's human problem. The well-meaning white people, I said, had to combat actively and directly the racism of other white people. The black people had to build within themselves a much greater awareness that along with equal rights, there had to be the bearing of equal responsibilities. Oh, that sounds very conservative, doesn't it? I have these very deep feelings that white people who want to join black organizations are really taking the escapist way to solve their own consciences. By visibly hovering near us, they are proving that they are with us. But the hard truth is that this isn't helping to solve America's racist problem. Aside from that, I mean nothing against sincere whites when I say that, as members of black organizations, generally the white man's very presence subtly renders the black organization automatically less effective. Even the best white members will slow down the Negro's discovery of what they need to do, and particularly what they can do for themselves. We will completely respect our white co-workers. We will give them every credit. They will deserve every credit. But meanwhile, we'll be working among our own people in our own black community, showing and teaching the black man in ways that only other black men can do, how the black man has got to help himself. Sometimes I have dared to dream to myself that one day history may even say that my voice, which disturbed the white man's smugness and his arrogance and his complacency, that my voice helped to save America from a grave, possibly an even fatal catastrophe. You know, again, you know, this kind of touching patriotism that comes out here. Every morning when I wake up now, I regard as having another borrowed day. In any city, wherever I go, making speeches, holding meetings in my organization, or attending to other business, black men are watching every move I make, waiting for a chance to kill me. This, of course, was his former brothers, the black Muslims, who were committed to gun down the apostate. I know, too, I could suddenly die at the hands of some white racist. Every day I live as though I am already dead. I do not expect to live long enough to read this book in its finished form, and if I can die, having brought any light, having exposed any meaningful truth that will help destroy the racist cancer that is malignant in the body of America, all credit is due to Allah. Only the mistakes have been mine. Okay, Malcolm X, of course, was gunned down by his brothers before his autobiography was off the press. And the mantle of leadership then fell very much to the figure of Eldridge Cleaver. Eldridge Cleaver and perhaps the Panthers have, in a certain sense, inherited the kind of program which Malcolm X attempted to put over. Malcolm X himself, of course, became almost a kind of messiah figure for the white, the black radical, the typical sort of sweatshirt with his face on it, and so on, that the kids wear. So he became kind of a patron saint of militant young people in the ghetto, a patron saint of somebody who really, you know, fought for black identity, but who had also gone beyond this kind of narrow racism of the Muslims. I think it's very important for white people to see that the black youth chose as their hero somebody who stood for all of the strong condemnation of racism, all the kind of affirmation of black identity, but at the same time repudiated a narrow racism. And Eldridge Cleaver, I think, is the sort of heir of that combination of things. Now, Eldridge Cleaver himself had a kind of similar background to Malcolm X. He, too, was a ghetto castaway. He was a prison inmate. When the Muslim doctrine came to him, he became a convert there. He, too, used the prison as a kind of place almost like a monastic discipline to study and to find himself. And out of that prison experience, of course, he wrote his autobiography, A Soul on Ice. But while he was in prison, he was also reading Malcolm X and decided that Malcolm X was right over against Elijah Muhammad. So he broke with Elijah Muhammad while he was in prison and moved to that group of people who saw Malcolm X as the real leader. While he was in prison, the word came to him that Malcolm had been assassinated, and Cleaver determined that he was going to try to take up and carry on Malcolm's organization of Afro-American unity and higher racial solidarity. So Eldridge Cleaver got out of prison with the determination to try to carry on Malcolm's program. And he went to San Francisco, and there he tried to sort of get together the remnants of Malcolm X's organization. He found that he couldn't do it, that the people were, just not really willing to get together. And then while he was in very frustrated efforts to revive Malcolm X's old organization, he stumbled upon the Black Panthers. And these people just completely won his heart. These were suddenly, he discovered these kind of, what he saw as very dynamic, intelligent, young black leadership. And he just went right to them as the people that he now saw as the ones who would be able to do the kind of thing that he wanted to do. He became the Black Panther Minister of Information. There are always kind of titles like that. Black Panther Minister of Information. And in the sort of year after his prison, he sort of went into a tremendous whirlwind of activity. He met and married Kathy Cleaver, who, you know, was really kind of the girl of his dreams. And when you read his biography, you can see how he had a lot of problems with girls. He gained the podium of some of the most prodigious universities in America. And so on, and finally topped it off by running for president as the candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party in the 1968 election. The state of California did not look very favorably upon these activities and began to find various ways to try to prove that Cleaver was violating his parole. And finally, and you can read about the story of that in the second book, Post-Prison Speeches and Writings, the kind of harassment that he got from the state all the time, who constantly were trying to trip him up. And you'll read his side of that famous shootout on which I think Bobby Seton is still in prison. And it's a very different kind of story from the official story. Okay, so anyway, his political activities then, of course, put him into a collision course with the state. Finally, you know, his parole was revoked, and Eldridge Cleaver determined that he would have to become a fugitive because he was convinced that he would be killed if he went back to prison, that they would find some way to sort of accidentally trip him down the stairs and so on like that. So he went into, he became a fugitive, and nobody knew where he was for a while, and now, according to information, he is in Cuba. Okay, now, what's Cleaver's position? Cleaver, as I said, tried to take up where Malcolm left off. This included a militant program of black self-help, social change, and self-defense, which was, of course, the Panthers' position. That the black man is a colonial people within America, that the white police operate in effect as a army of occupation in the black community, and so the black community has to arm for self-defense. He accepted that kind of idea, but also went on to that programs of social change and so on. The Black Panthers run a breakfast program in the black community. So on. But however, Eldridge Cleaver was the first black radical to really be able to sort of move back into a new relationship with the white radical. He really liked the white radical. He was perhaps the first black man who was mature enough not to be threatened by the young white radical, but to really see them as brothers, and to insist that a real social change in this country must come about by an alliance between these two groups. And I'll read you one little section where in this second book here where he talks about the white radical, and you can see what a very positive view he has of them. Whites in America really love this country, especially the young white idealists. They have been taught that they are living in the freest country in the world, the fairest country in the world, a country which will always have to support the underdog. So when they see their government murdering people in Vietnam, the outrage flowing from that realization is immeasurable. They don't storm the Pentagon immediately, but at a distance, they begin to focus on what is really going on. Now, people go through various stages of shock after a first awareness. They get angry, and then they get uptight. And finally, they want to do something to change what's going on. A lot of whites have already made a correct analysis of the situation. They are aware that the government of their country has been usurped, and that it is in the hands of a clique, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which manages the political system for the protection of large corporations. Having made that analysis, there are enough people right now, I believe, that are so outraged at the way things are going on that they would move against this usurpation if they knew how. Now, Cleaver, I think, himself didn't quite know how, but he did believe that the fragmentation of white and black radicals had to be overcome and that there had to be an alliance of these two groups. And on this basis, the Panthers supported the Peace and Freedom Party, and the Students for Democratic Society, in turn, you know, just practically went into a love affair with the Panthers. They were so, you know, happy to find some black people that loved them, you know. Cleaver felt that this new coalition had to be ready for violence. He felt that it had to be ready perhaps even for guerrilla warfare, similar to the kind of struggle going on in Vietnam, Latin America. He doesn't, you know, enjoy this kind of idea. There's one statement in there where he says, you know, guns are ugly. He doesn't enjoy this kind of idea at all, but he feels that it may come because the power structure may simply move against the radicals in a way that leave them no option. He also, of course, links up the liberation struggle with a sort of an anti-colonial struggle around the world. But amazingly enough, what comes out in this second book is that he really believes that White America is not ultimately going to let them down. In other words, he I don't know whether he still feels that way, but he makes these kind of amazing statements in which he says, this is in his Playboy interview, Hugh Hefner, I guess, asked him, well, aren't you afraid, you know, that these people are really going to get you? Aren't you afraid that you might really have a kind of genocide concentration camps here against black people if you keep sort of pushing these people and something like that? And Cleaver says, no, I don't think so, because I really think that the white majority in this country have too much of a sense of justice, that they're kind of passive, they're not aware of the situation. But if something like that began to happen, they would really get angry, and they wouldn't let it happen. In other words, he sort of ultimately opts for a kind of trust, not merely in the white radical, but in the white majority in America as a whole, that even though they have stood by and let things happen, you know, if it came to that kind of pass, they would really stand up and prevent it from happening. So he kind of puts a kind of trust in the ultimate goodwill of the white majority. And then finally, he rejects separatism as the final solution. He feels that the world is too small for different groups and different nationalisms to go their own way, that rather we have to create a kind of a new world community, and he feels that this new world community will have to be socialist. That is to say, there'll have to be a real restructuring of the socioeconomic structures of society as a whole, if these problems are going to be solved. So he sort of moves beyond racism and nationalism to socialism and to sort of a concept of world government. And I'll end with just reading this last thing from his post-prison writings, where he sort of sums this up. If the world is not going to destroy itself, the concept of people going their totally separate ways is really something that cannot continue indefinitely. When you start speaking in ultimate terms, I don't see any way in which the world can be administered for the best interest of mankind without some form of world government that would be responsible and responsive to all the people of the world. It is clear that in order for black people to have the best that society and technology are capable of providing, we need a new kind of society and a new kind of economic system. The goal must be to make possible a more equitable distribution of goods and services, but also to have a different set of values. And this is very important. We also have to have a different set of values so that things themselves do not become a substitute for life itself. Sounds like Holden Village. Now, in order to achieve that dual goal, we're going to have to move toward a new form of socialism. He's not talking about, you know, kind of old Marxism, but he's talking about some renewal of the socialist tradition that would be really, realize the ideals of this tradition. As long as there's so much stress on private property, we're going to have a society of competition rather than cooperation. I want to see a society purged of Madison Avenue mindbenders who propagandize people into a mad pursuit of gadgets. They have conned people into believing that their lives depend on having an electric toothbrush, two cars, and a color television in every room. We have got to rid ourselves of this dreadful and all-consuming hunger for things, this mindless substitution of the rat race for a humane life. This is not limited to black people. White people have got to disabuse themselves of the illusion that it is their job to rule and the black man's job is to produce the labor. The black men, in turn, have to use their minds and acquire confidence in the products of their minds. In other words, the black man has to, he has to sort of develop his upstairs. Now, this doesn't mean that the white man has to let his mind fall into disuse, but he also has to relate to his body again, as the black man does. In other words, the black man has to sort of discover his upstairs, and the white man has to sort of discover his downstairs. He has to learn to relate to his body again, as the black man does. Everybody needs a new understanding of his total nature, mental and physical. Only when people, black and white, start seeing themselves and acting as total human beings with bodies and minds will they stop assigning mental roles to one set of people and exclusively physical roles to another. Only then will the primary thrust of life, the fusion of male and female, be freed from sociological obstacles. It's very interesting, this point, that he suddenly links this up with a kind of a separation of male and female kind of roles. So that's Eldridge Baby. questions? Bill?
How about this new movement of BYU and the wet pickets and Kurt Chappell?
I don't know so much about the, I mean, I've been here for a month, which means that I don't know nothing that's happened. are the wits here? They know more about the Chicago situation. The Panthers, of course, can't all be necessarily equated with the high level of Elders Cleaver's own position, and they would differ in different cities. And in Chicago, of course, you get a kind of struggle between Panthers and the old street gangs, really, in effect. Keystone Rangers and so on like that. And I don't know enough of the insides of that. I suspect that the strongest and most mature group would still be the sort of Oakland group, which is where it began. Stokely Carmichael recently repudiated the Panthers on the grounds that they were slipping back to the old alliance of whites and blacks. And that was not, you know, the correct thing to do. And the Panthers, in turn, wrote a kind of a marvelous reply to that, which was really so kind of, above it all. It was just beautiful. They replied to Stokely by saying that we're very sorry that Brother Stokely has not understood the fuller dimensions of this problem. We tried to speak with him and get him to understand that racism is just not where it's at, you know. But he wasn't able to understand that, and that's too bad. But nevertheless, he's still our brother, you know, because we have room for a divergence of opinion and so on. So it's just, you know, such a marvelously balanced statement that I'm sure a lot of people were quite surprised. But I can imagine that on local level you have a lot of guys that are pretty short distance removed from the con man of the ghetto, because that's where life is there.
You didn't mention much about Stokely.
Yeah, well, Stokely would, of course, the Vine City Project on Whites in the Movement, I think, was written by him. If you read his book, Black Liberation in America, a lot of his sort of rhetoric, polemical rhetoric, is almost entirely absent. He almost has two different styles. One is his sort of podium rhetoric that gets people together, and then the style of this book, which is pretty much kind of straight ethnic politics, you know, very little different from you know, Irish politics or anything else, that, you know, that a group has got to organize. I always wonder how much Charles Hamilton, who's a good sociologist and political scientist, contributed to that book. But I think if you read that book of Stokely Carmichael, you'll find something that, you know, that Barry Goldwater could endorse.
But the very problem that you're never sure this is a true reflection of the individual.
I wouldn't say that I'm never sure. I think that if he writes that book, that's what he thinks. And that's what he felt was realistic politics. I think that he has, like a lot of people, has a rational side, which he thinks is that's how you're going to make it. But he also has very deep anger and alienation. And when you get up there and you're talking to the brothers, you know, you speak in a propagandistic way. Sounds, you know, you do that in the pulpit too.
It might be interesting for people to know that the head of the Black Panthers in Seattle is a poet, Aaron Dixon. He has a scholarship at the University of Washington on the basis of his poetry.
Yeah, I think you have to recognize that black militants in this country, an awful lot of them are the sons of the black middle class, and I think there's a tendency to assume, you know, that you're getting some terribly tough guys right out of prison. And in the case of Cleaver and Elders, sort of Malcolm X and so on, were extraordinary figures that sort of surmounted their own background and really became intellectuals. But the typical leadership of what we think of as militants really, by and large, comes out of you know, sons of the black middle class. You see a lot more dashikis and afros on the campus of Howard, you know, which is a straight black bourgeois school, than you would in the ghetto. In the ghetto, you know, it's still sort of the dude with the purple pants and the, you know, and the do-rag and so on like that. So this kind of style, is really a kind of intellectual style. I mean, even the founders of the Black Panthers, Bobby Seton, these were two college boys, you know, and they developed this thing while they were in college. And so. So I think when you see this from within the black community, you're very aware of how the black militant, is the son of the black middle class, very much as the white radical is the son of the white middle class. And at Howard, for example, the real sort of tension is between Negro daddy, black son, you know, this is, and Negret, you see, who represents the old black middle class who fought the old civil rights struggle. He's the Uncle Tom, and so, you know, so, and of course they finally, the whole struggle was against Negret, but he represented kind of the Negro daddy. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of hurt here, you know, you feel, when you're in this situation, you feel a terrible poignancy, because of course the old Negro middle class fought a good fight, and the only, in many ways, the only reason why the black militant can be so feisty is because his daddy won so much ground for him, you know. These guys at Cornell and so forth, you know, were so feisty. I mean, their fathers were the ministers and so on of the black community. So I think if you kind of you understand that context, it maybe makes a little bit more sense. I don't know.
Seaver doesn't seem to think that the separatism, black nationalism, is a stable focus for his movement now.
Not ultimately. I mean, he still believes, of course, that functionally black people organize a black community, but that they don't see that as the ultimate goal, that you get together in a larger coalition for social change.
They had a stable focus until it evolved into nationalism, separatism. I haven't really quite thought about it that way, that it could still move on. I don't quite know where it'll lead.
Well, I think that you have a focus within the black community for ethnic politics, but ethnic politics is never going to be enough, because the ethnic group itself is simply, you know, economically politically dependent upon the larger society. So if you organize, let's say, political leadership, you know, you have to organize it, let's say, in black wards in the city. But then ultimately, you've got to create a coalition if you're going to ever elect that guy a mayor or something like that. So I think you can do both, as ethnic politics has always done, to organize your own community, to get a strong basis, but then to enter into coalitions.